eyes widened, then I managed a laugh. She'd taken a mill town? I guess being a senator's wife makes you a little immune. That's exactly what I meant. And now, I'm off to take a written test on the second floor. She rested a hand on my arm. You'll do great. After she left, I went back to shuffling forward until it was my turn to go through the double doors and into a stark white and chrome ward filled with nurses in equally stark white uniforms. The nurse assigned to me got me settled on a chair next to a low enameled cart. She was a brisk white woman in her mid-50s with steel-gray hair tucked up under her nurse's cap. Her name tag said, Mrs. Rode.
Now, Mrs. York, we're just going to draw a little blood.
Of course. It made me glad I'd opted for a sweater set, since that made my arms easier to access. I pulled off the cardigan. The veins in my left arm are easier. Mrs. Rode raised an eyebrow.
Medical background?
My mother was a doctor in the First War. I held out my arm so she could wrap a rubber cord around it.
That explains... Oh!
She sprang up, moving past me to the woman on my other side. The nurse attending the woman was trying to keep her from slumping to the ground. Mrs. Rode grabbed her other arm. It was the woman who'd been standing behind me in the line. Her face was pale as a cloud bank and almost that damp. They got her propped back up in the chair. I hadn't even stuck her yet. The other nurse shook her head, feeling for the woman's pulse. Mrs. Rode shrugged.
Saves us time.
She turned and waved for an orderly to come over.
When she can stand, escort her to the waiting room and make sure she's okay before discharging her.
I shivered. Just like that. It wasn't as if the astronauts needed to do blood draws in space, but that little bit of a weakness and she was out. Maybe I should have taken a Milltown that morning, or maybe it was best that I didn't. I could second-guess for days. All I knew was that I was not going to faint over a needle. At least I had that. My nurse came back to me, brushing her hands off.
Sorry about that.
It's quite all right. I turned my chair so the woman who had fainted was outside my line of sight. She must be mortified. The least I could do was try to minimize her embarrassment by pretending not to have noticed. Mrs. Rode had good technique with the needle, and I barely felt it go in past the initial sting. The glistening steel tube stuck out of my arm like someone had welded a fuselage to me. Was it completely necessary for me to watch her? No. But I wanted to be sure she knew I wasn't afraid. You must be fatigued with all of us to go through. She shrugged.
It's better than the men. Ever tried taking a medical history from a pilot? They've apparently never been ill and were born through immaculate conception.
I laughed. It was shockingly loud. You know we're all pilots, right?
Yeah.
She pulled the tube of blood off the needle and capped it.
But they were all indoctrinated with the fact that an illness would get them grounded.
Ah. The brass didn't pay as much attention to the wasps. I took the gauze she handed me and pressed it against the crook of my arm when she withdrew the needle. So, what's next?
Just a few questions.
She jotted my name on the vial of blood and stuck it in a tray. Picking up a clipboard from the low cart, she pulled a pen from her uniform pocket. The questions were all standard and dull. My last period. History of illness. Pregnancies. Allergies.
What medications are you currently taking?
That one stopped me. I hadn't taken a Milltown this morning, and even when I did, it wasn't really for an illness. That's what she was trying to find out about, right?
Mrs. York?
Does aspirin count? Or vitamin C? I chewed my lower lip, trying to make it look like I wasn't being a pilot with a capital P. But goddammit, I wasn't going to let my anxiety ground me. And there's Dristan when I can't shake a cough. She shook her head.
I just need to know about things you take on a regular basis.
Oh, well, there's nothing then. And that was true. Right? The second day, I wore a pantsuit and tennis shoes. Entering the hospital lobby, it became clear that I was not the only one to change their wardrobe strategy. Once I checked in, the receptionist directed me to a lobby on the second floor. This room had wooden chairs lining the walls and another row back-to-back down the center. A single ivy plant struggled in the corner near the window as if it could escape the bland white walls. The chairs were occupied by more women in trousers than I'd previously seen in my life. Nicole spotted me and waved me over. She sat with Betty and two other women I hadn't met yet, Irene Leverton, a rancher's daughter, and Sarah Gorlick, a mother of eight. Sarah laughed at what must have been a priceless look on my face. I get that all the time. The way I figure it, if I can survive eight children, space is nothing. Nicole leaned forward to put a hand on my arm. Did you hear? They've eliminated three of us already. I know one woman fainted, plus another for anemia, and they say that Maggie had a heart murmur. She arched an eyebrow suggestively. Maggie, the only Chinese candidate, just happened to have a previously undiagnosed heart murmur. Ida would be livid when I told her tonight. An orderly with a clipboard appeared at the entrance to the lobby.
York, Coleman, Early, and Stedman.
See you later. I waved the little group a cheery farewell and joined the other three women. The orderly led us down a hall and dropped us each off at a different room. Mine was a small room with an examination chair, as if for an eye doctor. It smelled of sweat and a tinge of vomit. I suddenly became very glad that I'd spent the last month exercising to get ready for this, which led me to wonder where Herschel was right now. He should be arriving in South Carolina to meet Aunt Esther soon. Mrs. Rode, the nurse from the day before, gestured me over to the chair. Did Aunt Esther look the same? She had sounded the same, certainly, but how had the 5 years since the meteor treated her? Wait, Mrs. Rode had just said something. Sorry?
I need you to take your shirt off so we can monitor your heart.
Oh. The orderly had left the room, so we were, in fact, the only people here. I fumbled with the top button of my blouse. Of course. As she pasted discs to my chest, her hands were cold. Goosebumps rose on my arms, and I had to fight not to cross them over my chest. With wires trailing over to one of the machines, I settled into the chair. The cold metal stung my back, which really wasn't used to being exposed like this.
All right, Mrs. York. I want you to keep your eyes open for this procedure. Tell me about how you met your husband, and be sure to keep talking for the next 5 minutes.
Behind me, metal clanked against metal.
No matter what, keep talking and keep your eyes open.
All right. I met Nathaniel 3 times before we started seeing each other. Something cold brushed my ear. The first time was at Stanford. I was assigned to tutor his roommate in... Oh my God, what? Freezing liquid filled my right ear and my equilibrium was suddenly gone. The room spun around me in frantic circles. I clenched the seat of the chair with both hands. Eyes open, keep talking. Tutor, I was assigned to tutor his roommate in math, differential equations, but the fellow wasn't always there when I came, and... This was worse than being in a tailspin. There, at least, you could do something to pull out of the spin. And so Nathaniel and I would talk a little, about rockets mostly. The next semester, his roommate had a different roommate. God, I was barely making any sense. I didn't see him, Nathaniel. I didn't see Nathaniel again until the war. I was a WASP. I ferried some planes and did some training in New Mexico. He was there. He remembered me. I was less shy. We talked about rockets again. I couldn't get my eyes to focus. Even keeping them open took effort as the room whipped around me. The third time was Langley at NACA. I was visiting with my father. My father took me with him to visit NACA. Nathaniel was there. We talked about rockets, and he asked me a question about trajectories. I answered. The edges of the chair dug into my fingers as I fought to stay in my seat. Had other women fallen out? Had the men? I answered, and he offered me a job. He shouldn't have. Computers weren't his department. Engineer. He was the lead engineer. They'd done this to Stetson Parker. Whatever she'd stuck in my ear was something that had happened to Stetson Parker. The one thing I knew for certain about the testing was that we were being subjected to the exact same tests as the men. If he could survive this, so could I. He later said that he had wanted me for the engineering department, but then he couldn't have asked me out. The doorknob had a beam of light shining on it. I fixed my gaze on that and tried to let the room swing around that point. It helped, a little. It never occurred to me that a woman could be an engineer, and the computer department was all women, so that seemed like a natural fit. I was there for 2 months when he asked me to go to the Christmas party with him. I told him I was Jewish. It turned out that he was, too, but it was the company party, so... Mrs. Rhodes stepped in front of me and clicked a stopwatch.
Very good, Mrs. York. 4 minutes, 38 seconds. That's quite good. You may close your eyes now.
The darkness was a welcome relief. The room still spun, but not as badly. What was that?
Super-chilled water to freeze your inner ear. It's an equilibrium test to see how well you can function when unbalanced. We look to see when your eyes stop rolling as a sign that you've gained a measure of control.
And I could only focus after 4 minutes and 38 seconds? In a plane, that would have killed me if it had taken me that long to pull it together.
Yes, but you were able to function the entire time. You may put your shirt on, but we'll leave the heart monitors in place for the next test.
Something cloth, presumably my shirt, landed in my lap.
And thank you for not vomiting.
The rest of the day followed similar baffling and unpleasant lines. There was a table that they strapped you to, turned you upside down for 5 minutes, and then jerked it upright to see if you'd faint from the sudden change in orientation. A treadmill that rose at a steady rate as you ran to simulate a run up a mountain. There were other examinations, some of them less dignified than a trip to the gynecologist, which is saying something. When I was sweaty, tired, and annoyed, they gave me written tests about orbital mechanics. With each round, there were fewer and fewer of us. Some hadn't been able to get through a crucial part of the testing. I nearly didn't make it through the run uphill, and other women changed their minds. Those of us who stayed, though, had an odd mix of camaraderie and fierce competitiveness. We were, after all, pilots.
34 women took astronaut tests. Kansas City, Kansas, May 16th, 1957, AP. 34 women were chosen to undergo a preliminary testing program to be lunar astronauts. All 34 are airline pilots, and their ages range from 23 to 38. These beauties range from blonde to brunette and are among the best feminine specimens on the planet.
By day 4, there were just 21 of us left. Betty and Nicole were still in the running, as was Sabia. Sometimes we were in the same testing room. Other times it was a solo ordeal like the inner ear test. After I endured the joys of having a metal cup pressed against my eyeball to test for glaucoma, I walked into an interview room. Stetson Parker sat at a table, flanked on one side by Benkoski and the other by Director Clemens.
Bloody hell!
Clemens threw his pen down on the table.
We don't really need to interview her, do we?
Thank God I was already sweaty from the treadmill earlier, because it masked the cold sweat that broke out of every pore. I know that I've tried your patience, but... Clemens waved his hand, and I stopped talking out of habit. He picked up his pen again and aimed it at me.
You misunderstand. We're supposed to see if the candidates have the drive an astronaut needs. That is hardly a question with you.
Oh. I looked back at the door. Should I send in the next person?
No.
Parker leaned back in his chair.
I think we should do this right so no one can accuse us of favoritism later. Why don't you sit down, Mrs. York, and tell us why you want to be an astronaut?
Favoritism. But I sat down in the chair facing the men and rested my hands on my knees with my ankles crossed, the way Mama had taught me. Don't ask me why I wanted to sit like a lady when I was wearing rumpled pants and a sweat-dampened shirt. It might just have been the only armor I owned. For once, I was glad for all the interviews that I had done because this was a question that I had answered over and again. Why do I want to be an astronaut? Because I believe that women have a necessary role in establishing colonies on other planets. If we have...
I'm not interested in your speeches.
Parker sat upright with a thump.
If I wanted those, I could read a magazine.
Colonel Parker!
Clemens glared at him.
This is not how we treat candidates. We all know why she thinks women should go into space.
He turned to face me again.
I want to know why you, specifically you, want to be an astronaut. And why you want to do that now, at this stage of the program.
I stared at him. I didn't have an answer. Or at least not one that I could articulate. I just wanted to, in the same way I wanted to fly. I discarded the truth, which was that I didn't really know, and instead reached for answers like the ones that I'd seen the astronauts give in interviews. I feel that it's my duty to...
To serve your country. That's the answer someone gives to the press corps.
Parker shook his head. Neither of the other two men stepped in this time. All three men stared at me, waiting. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. If I could talk to Congress or appear on national television, I could answer these men. I don't remember a time when flying wasn't a part of my life. My father was a pilot. I used to beg him to do barrel rolls when I was little because I loved the way the earth spread out below us, and gravity didn't seem to matter. I opened my eyes but still stared at the polished linoleum floors as I felt my way through my answer. Space seems... I'm a pilot, you know? Space seems... necessary, or inevitable, or... I spread my hands, struggling to find words I was willing to say to them about how I yearned to go there. Maybe it was all the science fiction novels and comic books my dad gave me, but the idea of not going into space seems more impossible than anything else. Even if the Earth weren't damaged, I'd still want to go. Binkowski gave a little grunt, his pencil scratching on a form. Clemens had his arms crossed over his chest and his lips pursed as if he were holding a cigar. And Parker was nodding. God help me. The man who had said he would keep me grounded was nodding as if he understood. Then he shrugged and picked a notebook off the table.
What's the reliability data on the Atlas booster?
The sudden shift in topic left me a little startled. Fewer than 9 out of 10 Atlas launches were successful. That's why we moved to the Jupiter design. Clemens kept his arms crossed over his chest while Binkowski jotted down my response.
What are the advantages of pressure carburetors over float carburetors?
Pressure carburetors are less likely to exhibit carb icing, which can initially lead to the engine running more rich, but will eventually restrict the airflow and cause a complete blockage. And they provide a stable fuel-air ratio under negative G conditions, such as a rapid dive or inverted flight. It is astonishing how much more comfortable I am with technical questions than personal ones. From then on, the interview was almost simple. When Herschel asked for a hotel recommendation, I sent him to the Aladdin, which is where Nathaniel and I had stayed after the bomb threat. Its lobby had a second-floor balcony with a martini bar. The balcony was supported by black marble pillars, and the gilding on the railings and at the top of the columns gave a pre-meteor golden age elegance to the place. As appealing as the martini bar was, after surviving 5 days of testing, it was probably not a good plan to drink before meeting Aunt Esther. Maybe after that I would have all the martinis they could make. We made our way through the lobby and back to the restaurant attached to the rear of the hotel. It was intimate, with pretensions of elegance. When we'd been here before, the food had been solid, if uninspired. The maitre d' glided forward to meet us, menus in hand.
To this evening?
Across the room, Herschel leaned out from a booth and waved. Nathaniel shook his head.
No, thank you. We're meeting someone.
He may have said other things, but I was already past him and hurrying between the rows of tables. Herschel had grabbed his crutches and was pushing up to his feet as I got close. He'd brought Tommy with him, and he looked every inch the young man. He wore his dinner jacket from the bar mitzvah and had his hair slicked down with Brill Cream. Herschel braced himself on one crutch and held out an arm for an embrace. I hugged him, suddenly shy about greeting the poof of white hair I'd passed. He gave me a good solid squeeze and murmured,
"You look beat."
"Good to see you, too." I thumped his back before releasing him and facing my aunt. She beamed up at me with the strong Wexler stamp from my father's side of the family. I don't know why Aunt Esther never married, but she had a sort of kittenish charm, even over 90. Her white curls had been pinned into place in a style held over from the 1880s. There was powder caught in the wrinkles on her cheeks, but her eyes were as bright as ever. She held out both hands to me.
"Anselma, let me look at you."
"Only if I get to look back." I sank onto the seat beside her, hoping that Tommy would forgive me for not hugging him yet. "You haven't changed a bit."
"Once you hit a certain age, it's hard to look older."
She reached up to pinch my cheek.
"They aren't feeding you enough at that school of yours."
"School?" I shot a glance over to Herschel, who was just shaking hands with Nathaniel.
The test you were doing.
Herschel put a hand on the back of the booth and lowered himself to sit next to Tommy. Oh, that's not school, really. I'm applying to be an astronaut. Tommy perked up at that.
That's just the keenest thing. What was it like? Did you meet Stetson Parker? How do you get tested? And Dad said we're going to see a rocket launch while we're here.
I'm not sure which question to answer first. Aunt Esther had a hand cupped around her ear.
What did he say?
He asked how the astronaut testing went. She frowned, cocking her head to the side like a bird.
Well, now that's what I thought he said. But I have to confess I'm not real clear on what an astronaut is. I keep hearing it on the news, but it just sounds like some sort of story.
An astronaut is someone who goes into outer space.
Well, that's the silliest thing I ever heard of. Why would anyone want to do that?
I'd spent the day trying to explain that to a series of shrinks who seemed determined to ask many of the same questions that Clemens and the gang had. Defending the desire to an aunt I'd just rediscovered lay beyond my abilities. Let's just say that I'm sort of applying for a new job. She shook her head and said something in Yiddish, but too quickly for me to catch. I'd never really spoken Yiddish since my parents hadn't. I used to love listening to Aunt Esther and Grandma and the other aunts kvetch, though. I put my hand on her papery thin one. Sorry, can you repeat that in English?
Why are you working?
She gave Nathaniel a meaningful look.
Why is your wife working?
She likes it, and I try to make sure she has what she likes.
Nathaniel winked at Aunt Esther as he settled on the bench next to Herschel.
You want me to make sure your niece is happy, right?
She's just like her father and her grandmother.
She pinched my cheek again, and I began to see why Tommy was sitting next to his father. I'd forgotten this aspect of Aunt Esther. She was the baby of the aunts, which is a funny term to apply to someone who was over 90.
I would be dead were it not for Rose.
I cleared the tears from my throat. How did y'all get out? She laughed a little and clapped her hands.
We went to church.
Glancing at Herschel, I raised my eyebrows questioningly, but he shrugged.
Aunt Esther, I thought you said that you drove out of Charleston.
Oh, yes. Later, that's what we did, but first Rose took us to the church in town. You remember the one with the big steeple? It's the first time I set foot in a Christian church, but Rose, she said we had to, and so we climbed all the way up to the top of the bell tower. I've never seen so many steps in my life.
The church with the big steeple? I had no idea which one she was talking about. We'd moved around so much when I was a kid that my knowledge of Charleston was limited to how to get from Grandma's house to my cousin's, the synagogue, cemetery, and grocery store. The priorities were clear, at least. That's amazing. And how...
Good evening, everyone. Have you had an opportunity to look over the menu?
That poor waiter. I don't think I've ever hated anyone quite as much as I hated him in that moment. It wasn't his fault. He had a job to do, and truly, I should eat something. But I wanted to hear more about the church. I'll need a minute.
I can order for you if everyone else is ready.
Nathaniel looked up from his menu.
The menu hasn't changed from when we were here before. Take your time!
The young man flashed his teeth in a way that said that he was really an actor. He was handsome if you go for the Clark Gable type, but he was never going to land any roles if his next line was any indication of his acting ability.
Say, aren't you the lady astronaut?
Only on TV, not when I'm having dinner with my family. Which was maybe a little too sharp, so I gave a sugar-laden smile to counterbalance it. You understand, right, honey? Poor kid. He'd thought he could suck up by recognizing me. His face fell, and you could see him thinking that he'd kissed his tip goodbye. Herschel had covered his mouth and was studying the menu with the intensity of a man trying not to laugh.
Sorry, ma'am.
The waiter made a vague gesture to another part of the restaurant.
There's a family with some little girls, and they recognized you. I said... They were shy, and I said I could help them out.
Oh. Well, that changed things. And I had to give him credit for not backing down from a promise to kids, even if all I really wanted to do was spend time with my aunt. Aunt Esther watched the whole conversation with quiet interest, her head tilted to the side as each of us spoke, which just made her look more like a little bird. When I had visited as a child, she and Grandma had always made time for me and my endless questions. Did I repay that by giving her my attention now, or by following her example and visiting the little girls? Sighing, I turned to Nathaniel. Would you order for me? I'll be right back. It says something that I wasn't nervous walking over there. Maybe I was just worn out from the testing, or maybe I was finally getting used to the spotlight. I could hope for the latter. The family was sitting at a table close to the entrance. The wife wore a small Star of David on a chain. My heart lifted a little at that. Funny how, even though I was there with my family, just seeing someone else who was visibly Jewish made me feel less alone in the room. The younger of the little girls spotted me first, and her brown eyes went wide. Her rosebud of a mouth dropped open. She poked her sister in the side.
Ow, Mama! Shoshana is poking me! Oh, my gosh!
The older girl was perhaps 10 and had the same dark brown curls as her little sister.
Oh, my gosh!
The father looked around in the direction of his daughter's stairs. Seeing me, he pushed his chair back and stood.
Thank you for coming over, Dr. York. I hope we didn't interrupt your dinner.
Not at all. It's just a family gathering. Telling him that it included an aunt who I'd thought was dead would only make him feel guilty.
Robert Horn. My wife, Julia?
A pleasure. I shook her hand. The skin was rough and chapped as if she spent a lot of time washing dishes.
And these are our daughters, Honey and Shoshana.
The obvious parental pride shone through his smile.
They are big fans of yours.
I'm going to be an astronaut,
Shoshana announced.
I bet you will.
I turned my attention to Hani. And how about you?
A writer.
And then, as if seeking my approval, she added,
but I'll write about space.
Well then, it sounds like the future will be a wonderful place. We chatted about nothing, which I had become very practiced at over the past several months. What I'd come to realize is that, with kids like these, it was less about me and more about elevating them. Not because it was me, but because I was something out of the ordinary. It's easy to confuse that with extraordinary. I wasn't. I could have been anybody, so long as I was somebody, if that makes any sense. They would have been just as excited to meet Hedy Lamarr. Though, to be fair, I would also be excited to meet Hedy Lamarr. For me, the out-of-the-ordinary person that I met that night was Aunt Esther. When I got back to the table, she had Nathaniel, Tommy, and Herschel crying with laughter. Literally crying. Nathaniel had gone red in the face and was blotting his eyes with his napkin. I slid onto the bench, jealous at missing whatever the story had been. Aunt Esther's cheeks had a flush of red to them, and her wrinkles were twisted up in a bow. Fortunately, Nathaniel had ordered a martini for me, so I had that for consolation. Tommy grinned at me.
The damn thing's hot!
Look what you've done.
Herschel shook a finger at our aunt, who did not look even a little abashed.
He's going to teach that to his sister, and my wife will have my head.
Eileen won't mind.
Doris.
Herschel wiped his eyes and sobered a little. Our cousin Kenny and his wife Eileen had died in the meteor. Presumably. Like most, they'd just vanished.
My wife's name is Doris.
I know.
She picked up a low tumbler which smelled like a rum and coke and gave him a wink.
How is she doing?
Doris is doing pretty well. She's looking forward to seeing you. So is my daughter, Rachel.
Herschel also had a martini. He lifted it.
Now that we're all here, l'chaim.
To life indeed. I lay sprawled across the bed while Nathaniel rubbed my feet. His thumbs dug into the ball of my right foot in a searching circular pattern like a tension-finding radar.
So I take it dancing is out?
He ran one thumb down the arch of my foot. I groaned and pulled a pillow over my face. I'll need a compelling reason to leave this bed, ever.
I might be able to provide that.
The motion of his hand changed to a softer pressure that sent shivers up my spine. That feels more like a reason to stay in bed. I pressed the pillow more firmly over my face. My husband has a wonderful laugh.
Fine. Stay in bed.
What was the story Aunt Esther told tonight, while I was with the little girls?
Oh, God, I nearly died.
His fingers worked around the back of my heel to my Achilles tendon and then up my calf.
I don't think I can tell her the way she does, though. Apparently, when your father was little, they're having a party and your dad sees his first electric light. He touches it and says, "The damn thing's hot." Now, you have to picture your Aunt Esther saying that.
I could just see her with her delicate features and bright eyes chirping, "The damn thing's hot." Things you don't expect small children or little old ladies to say. I'm sorry I missed that.
How about you? I didn't get to hear anything about the testing today.
Under the pillow, the world was warm and had the suffused light of dense cloud cover. Low visibility was fine by me. I'd spent the past 5 days being tested along every axis they could think of, and some I hadn't known existed. The centrifuge was fun.
Ha! You are the only person I know who would say that unironically.
I pushed the pillow up so I could stick my tongue out at him. Any idea how long before we hear back? He shook his head and lifted my foot a little higher.
Not my area. I'm more concerned with the health and morale.
Nathaniel bent down so his hair fell across his forehead and took my big toe into his mouth. His teeth nibbled the tip, and my back arched as he withdrew his mouth.
Of specific candidates.
I see. Pulling my foot back, I slid it down his chest to nestle into the place where his thighs met. And what is your candidate criteria? Besides an ability to handle being placed in a centrifuge chair, of course. Nathaniel's hips flexed to match my pressure, and for a moment his eyes flickered closed. A lazy smile ghosted across his face as he leaned forward.
Well, clearly the centrifuge indicates an ability to work with compromised blood flow, which is, necessary for a pilot.
Is that why women are able to handle higher G-forces than men? I traced a line up the inside of his thigh. What other qualifications does your candidate possess? The bed creaked beneath me as Nathaniel shifted to his knees.
It's critical that suitable candidates have experience with rocketry.
What type of experience? Should I demonstrate my experience ensuring that the rocket is topped up and ready for launch? Beneath my hands, his body seemed supercharged with heat. His shirt bunched under my touch as I found my way to his belt. Nathaniel leaned down, his breath hot against my cheek.
That would be acceptable.
Acceptable? I wrapped my legs around his waist and pulled him down against me. I plan on being excellent. 31.
Dr. King to lead anti-bias trek. 15,000 Southern Negroes going to Capitol to observe fourth year of school decree. Montgomery, Alabama, May 18th, 1957. Next week, a young Negro minister will lead a pilgrimage to the Meteor Memorial in Kansas City to mark the fourth anniversary of the Supreme Court's school desegregation order.
Saturday morning, we all went to synagogue together. Several times during the service, I had to press my handkerchief to my eyes because I would look at Aunt Esther beside me and half expect to see Grandma on her other side or Mama and Daddy behind me. I was so very glad to have her back, but she brought ghosts with her. Nathaniel hadn't been able to join us because it was a launch day. Ever since the Orion 27 disaster, he wouldn't miss a launch. Rockets still blew up occasionally when they were being tested, but those were just data points. That evening, we all went over to Mission Control to watch the launch. It was a manned craft, heading for the orbital platform. I say platform, but it was more donut-shaped than flat. rotating to create a limp, artificial gravity. The night was warm, and banks of clouds bounced the lights of the launch tower back down to the earth in a sodium-orange haze. Baffles gave some shelter to the rooftop, but wind snuck past it and cooled the sweat from the back of my neck. I still hadn't gotten used to being warm outside again. The loudspeakers punctuated our conversation with the countdown. The public affairs officer on duty kept up a running commentary for the spectators, both at the IAC and listening via the radio.
4 minutes, 15 seconds. The test supervisor now has informed the launch vehicle test conductor that they are go for launch.
Perhaps with the weather warming, folks would start coming to the roof earlier for launches. We tended to wait until T-minus 4 minutes because it was too cold, even in the summer.
3 minutes, 45 seconds, and counting. In the final abort checks between several key members of the crew here in the control center and the astronauts, launch operations manager wished the crew good luck and Godspeed.
Aunt Esther had produced a painted fan from somewhere and created a miniature breeze of her own. I smiled at her. What a lovely fan. Aunt Esther preened, waving it in a lopsided circle.
Rose gave it to me. I hadn't thought to grab my own when we left home, but she always had one in her bag.
3 minutes, 25 seconds and counting. We're still go at this time. We'll be coming up on the automatic sequence about 10 or 15 seconds from now. All still go at this time.
Really?
Memories of sitting on the front porch with lemonade and Grandma stirring the air with her fan tickled the back of my mind. It's beautiful.
She got it in Spain.
T-minus 2 minutes, 45 seconds and counting. The members of the launch team here in the control center are monitoring a number of what we call red line values.
Herschel had gone ahead with Tommy and leaned against the railing on the far side of the roof. Downstairs, my nephew had met Minkowski's son, Max, with whom I'd made tinfoil rockets. They were becoming fast friends. I smiled at my aunt, unsure if this was a true story or her spotty memory. Grandma went to Spain?
She and your grandfather went for their honeymoon.
It had never occurred to me that they must have had a honeymoon. Granddaddy died before I was born, and Grandma had seemed eternal.
I had no idea. Did you ever...
T-minus 1 minute, 25 seconds, and counting. Our status board indicates the third stage is completely pressurized.
Things would start moving quickly now, and I didn't want her to miss a thing. Night launches were spectacular.
There are some seats over here.
I beckoned Aunt Esther to the folding chairs set up on the roof.
T-minus 60 seconds and counting. Randy Cleary just reported back. It's been a very smooth countdown. We've passed the 50-second mark. Power transfer is complete. We're on internal power with the launch vehicle at this time. 40 seconds away from liftoff. All the second stage tanks are now pressurized. 35 seconds and counting. We are still go with 30 seconds and counting. Astronauts report it feels good. T-minus 25 seconds.
Aunt Esther's cheeks blossomed with roses, and she settled into her chair like an eager child. Truly, she wasn't much bigger than one. She had been a small woman my entire life, but I swear she was a good 4 inches shorter than before the meteor.
20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence starts.
8, 7, 6. We joined in the countdown with everyone else on the roof, and my stomach knit itself into a tight ball.
5, 4, 3.
Every time we launched, I worried that this one would fail. That we would watch 3 astronauts lost in a massive explosion.
2, 1, 0. All engines running.
In the distance, the base of the rocket sprouted the vivid yellow-white fire of a successful ignition. In silence, it rose on this cushion of flame. The night around us lit up like day.
Liftoff. We have liftoff.
Beside me, Aunt Esther rose to her feet, hands clasped in front of her chest. The light of the rocket reflected off her bright eyes as if the fire of her soul were coming out to push the rocket into the sky. Then the sound hit us, a heavy rumble that you felt more than heard. The force of the waves beat against my chest. What must it be like to ride that sound in fury? I held my breath, praying for the rocket to keep going. The blaze of fire pushed it faster and higher into the air until it disappeared into the cloud cover and left us with just a traveling glow that faded back into the night. Aunt Esther turned to me and grasped both of my hands. "Thank you, for I never thought I would see such a thing. I didn't know why you'd want to be an astronaut or even really what one was, but now..." She looked up to the clouds where all trace of the rocket had vanished. "You must." After my family left, it was back to the grind of computing. That makes it sound like I didn't enjoy it, when I did. It's just that, having spent a month preparing for those tests and then 5 days immersed in the potentiality of becoming an astronaut, it was hard to go back to something mundane. It's true that I was still helping the program, but I wanted to go into space. The fact that Helen hadn't gotten in also rankled. She had bounced back to her usual cheer on the surface, but she, Ida, and Imogene had stopped coming to the 99s. They were using their free time to rack up jet engine hours. The really absurd thing about that requirement was that astronauts barely flew anything. Sure, they had to go into outer space, but there was a reason that Chuck Yeager called it being spam in a can. Most of the systems were automated. It would be different on the way to the moon, but even that would be nothing like flying a jet. Meanwhile, the Sirius rocket that Bubbles had designed was ready for a launch test. All the static firings in the world wouldn't count until we actually sent it into the air. I tapped the trajectory pages together into a stack and tucked them into a folder. "Be right back. I'm going to run this down to Bubbles." Masira looked up from her desk with a pout. "Oh, let him come for them. He's so adorable." "You should ask him out on a date." I slid my chair back and stood. She barked a laugh. "I'm pretty sure he's supposed to ask me." "That would involve him realizing that the computers are women.
A man who asks for a computress doesn't know that?"
She snorted and turned back to her pages.
"Please, I just think he doesn't know what to do with us."
"Which is why you should ask him out." I winked and headed for the door.
"Should I tell him you asked about him? Don't you dare!"
She flung a wadded-up piece of paper after me and hit Myrtle by mistake, which set the whole room to giggling. Still laughing, I headed down the hall to the engineering wing. The practical labs, which is where Bubbles usually worked, were in a different building from us because they tended to blow things up. Thank heavens for the gerbil tubes that connected our buildings. Otherwise, I would have had to step into the heat to run the report over. I opened the door to the stairwell up to the sky bridge. Down a floor, a conversation cut off.
"Told you I'm fine. Shh."
That hush echoed up the stairwell. It took a second to identify the voice, only because I'd never heard Stetson Parker sound stressed. Not even when there was a bomber on the IAC campus. I leaned over the railing and looked down. He sat on the bottom step with one leg stretched out in front of him. Halim Malouf stood over him, hands on his hips. "Y'all need any help?" At the sound of my voice, Parker's head jerked up and around.
"Everything is fine."
"Are you sure?" It was tempting to leave him, but the lines of his face were drawn tight. "I can get a medic."
"No!"
His voice echoed up to the top of the stairwell and back down again. Parker closed his eyes and let out a slow breath.
"No, thank you. That won't be necessary. I think maybe it is."
Malouf rubbed the back of his neck.
"Stetson, it's been getting worse." "Don't you say another word."
Parker jabbed a finger up at him, then glared at me.
"And you, I don't want to hear a peep about this from you."
Pulled down the stairs by their gravity, my heels clicked against the concrete steps. "If there's nothing wrong, then there's nothing for me to tell."
"You really like pushing things, don't you, York?"
Parker grabbed the railing and hauled himself upright. His left leg hung loose under him. "What happened?" I stopped on the stairs, clutching the trajectory folder as a shield between us.
Nothing happened. I just slipped on the stairs, that's all.
He took a limping step away from the stairs and his left leg buckled under him.
Oh, hell.
Malouf caught him, easing Parker to the ground. I ran down the stairs to try to help. Are you okay?
Yes, I'm fine.
You can't stand.
I fucking know that.
Parker pressed his fingers to the bridge of his nose and squeezed his eyes shut. He held his breath for a moment, then he blew it out and lowered his hand.
York, I'm going to ask you as a favor. One pilot to another. Please don't say anything. You have the power right now to have me grounded. Please, please don't.
Well, I'm sympathetic to fears of being grounded.
Please.
I took another step closer. As much as I might have dreamed about Parker begging me for something, this wasn't what I wanted. I wanted to be better than him. Winning because he was sick? No, thank you. What's wrong?
I don't know. If I go to the flight surgeon, he'll ground me.
As well he should. A leg like that could jeopardize a mission, and for that matter, why hadn't Malouf told anyone already? Maybe it was recent. My thoughts went to stories my parents told about when Herschel got sick. It had started with a weakness in his leg. Have you had a fever?
It's not polio.
I pulled back, a little startled that his thoughts went there, too. How do you—
I know what polio looks like. All right?
He scowled at me.
Why are you still here, anyway? Shouldn't you be scampering off to report this to the newspaper?
Behind his back, Malouf made a subtle shooing motion, but not unkindly.
I think everything is under control, Dr. York.
Of course. I started up the stairs and stopped at the next landing. Even if Parker were grounded, that wouldn't keep him from having a say in who got selected. I won't tell anyone, but you should see a doctor. Just maybe not the flight surgeon? I almost offered to take him, but I wasn't that big of a person. On launch days, there's usually nothing for a computer to do until after liftoff. We've already done the calculations about alternate launch windows or adjusted trajectories for rendezvous so that Clemens and the launch director can make decisions based on known information if there's a delay. But we still have to come into mission control with the rest of our team. Helen was playing chess with Reynard Carmouche while I was looking at the places where it was possible to abort the moon mission if something went wrong. That thing we say about how engineers create problems and computers solve them? Yeah. Nathaniel had given the computer department a list of possible failure points, and then asked how we could get the astronauts home under these varying conditions. To put this into perspective, the Sirius has 5,600,000 parts and close to 1 million systems, subsystems, and assemblies. Even if everything was 99.9% reliable, that would still be 5,600 defects. It wasn't a question of if something would go wrong on the way to the moon. It was a question of when and what. And when that failure occurred, it would occur in a spacecraft that was traveling at 25,000 miles per hour. We weren't going to have time to run calculations then. So the idea was to create a library of possible answers so we could access a month's worth of work in a few minutes. Tonight, with 3 hours of waiting time before ignition, the failure state calculations were a pleasant way to pass the time. And yes, I'm aware that I'm odd. I wasn't alone, however. At his station, Nathaniel had a pile of reports and was gnawing his way through a pencil. Bubbles had a similar binder in front of him, though given that it was his baby we were about to launch, that wasn't surprising. Not everyone was working, of course. Parker was up in the skybox with Clemens, hobnobbing with the journalists. Today he didn't have a trace of a limp. What the hell had it been? Not polio, for certain. Mama would have known what it was, but I didn't have anyone I could ask without it getting back to him. Maybe I could inquire with the doctor when I went in to see him for my Milltown refill.
Again?
Carmouche leaned back in his chair with a groan.
Someday, I swear that someday I will win.
Helen crossed her arms and smirked at him.
It is only check. You still have a chance.
He harrumphed and leaned forward to stare at the board. I lowered my pencil. If you just want to win, you could play against me. Shaking his head, Carmouche continued to glare at the board. He reached forward for a pawn, glanced at Helen, and pulled his hand back. Under his breath, he muttered in French about either Helen's parentage or the options for play. Either way, it sounded irritable.
Est-ce qu'il vous bat de nouveau?
Parker walked up behind me and I flinched in my seat. I swear he did that on purpose.
Oui, il est l'ordre naturel, je pense.
Carmouche sighed and tapped his fingers on the edge of the board.
Il n'y a rien de naturel.
Parker looked down at me.
York, Clemens wants you.
And he sent you down all those stairs for little old me? I am at times a complete idiot. Antagonizing him was the last thing I needed to do. I pushed back my chair, aware that Helen and Carmouche were staring at us. Thank you. I followed him across the floor of Mission Control. Across the room, Nathaniel had his head buried in reports and didn't look up. Any idea why? Parker pulled the door open but did not hold it for me. I caught it, following him into the stairwell. He bounded up the stairs two at a time as if he had something to prove. Feeling better, I see. I chased him up the stairs, grateful for the time I'd spent preparing for the astronaut tests. Even in a skirt and heels, I could run up a flight of stairs without getting winded. At the top of the stairs, Parker waited beside the door with a face of stone. He was a handsome man, I'd grant him that. He and Nathaniel were both blondes with bright blue eyes, but where my husband was lean and angular, Parker had the ideal physique of a movie star with a square jaw and a cleft chin. When I came up alongside him, he put a hand on the doorknob and suddenly smiled as if we were the best of friends. The speed with which he turned on the charm left me chilled. Parker threw the door open, holding it for me to walk through. Of course he would hold the door and smile now that there were witnesses. The room was full of astronauts and their wives, and reporters here to cover the launch of a new class of spacecraft. Clemens turned, one of his cigars smoldering in his hand.
There she is. Gentlemen, meet Elma York, one of our computers and responsible for the calculations that identified the potential of the Sirius engine. Dr. York is also our newest astronaut.
The room went hot. Cold, hot. I must have misheard. Surely they would tell me that in private first. Flashbulbs went off, blinding me. I couldn't breathe. Astronaut. The room spun around me like I was strapped in a centrifuge chair. Breath pressed out, my vision darkened at the edges. Astronaut. 3.14159265359. Someone said my name. If I fainted, what would people think? Parker would like that. Astronaut. Why the hell wouldn't they tell me that in private first? You didn't blindside someone with a thing like that unless you wanted to watch them flounder. Parker. Parker must have suggested this. Someone said my name again, and I turned to the voice. The room was a blur of sound and light. There wasn't enough air. Keep your eyes open. Keep talking. This was just another test. Gentlemen, I fought gravity to raise my hands. Gentlemen, if you all talk at once, I can't hear you. They ignored me and kept shouting over each other.
When will you go into space? What does your husband think about this? How does it feel to be an astronaut?
That voice belonged to a round, balding man with his tie pulled loose. An astronaut? That sounds as if I should be doing kicks in a chorus line. The laughter gave me a boost to find a smile somewhere. So please, I'm just an astronaut. Just an astronaut. Ha! I was a goddamned astronaut. Not that they would print that.
Now, now. You're the lady astronaut from Mr. Wizard.
Parker smiled genially beside me.
We wouldn't want anyone to forget that.
Is she the only lady astronaut?
Another reporter fired at Clemens. Damn, Parker. That moniker was going to stick, and it would make sure we were always second class to the men. Clemens waved his cigar, leaving contrails of smoke.
No, she is not. But you'll meet the rest of them next week at our press conference. I just wanted to give you a preview of the talent and beauty of our lady astronauts.
God damn it. I smiled until my teeth hurt. Well, this astronaut has some calculations to do.
Of course.
Clemens waved me back to the door.
Sirius is waiting.
The reporters hollered for some more photos, so I had to stand there, smiling, between Parker and Clemens. Both men beamed at the camera, and in the pictures we all looked like the best of friends. Then Parker held the door for me as if he were a gentleman. I stepped into the stairwell, and the door shut behind us. His smile dropped. "This must really rankle you." I started down the stairs ahead of him, after saying you'd keep me grounded. His laughter bounced down the stairs after me.
"Please. If Clemens hadn't hired you, it would have been a public relations nightmare. And the other women, they've earned it. You're just a publicity stunt."
Bastard. My heart galloped as if I'd run up 5 flights of stairs instead of down one. I slammed the door open and stalked onto the floor of Mission Control. A few heads lifted as my heels clicked across the floor. The reporters were probably still watching. Thank God my back was to them. Whatever Parker said in the stairwell, I was still an astronaut. I'd been selected, and by God, I was going to go into space. Publicity stunt? Ha! Huh. I was going to be the best damn student they had. Back at my table, the tableau was much as it had been before. Carmouche had evidently made a move because he was slumped in his chair, shaking his head. "Did you lose again?"
"No, but she has me in check again. A different one, at least."
Helen studied the board. "I will try to put you out of your misery quickly." "The offer to play against me still stands." I settled into my chair, smoothing my skirt to wipe the sweat off my palms. Helen nodded to the skybox from which all the reporters were staring at us. "What was that all about?" This was good news, despite Parker, so I smiled and, in smiling, found the joy that should have been there already. I made the cut. I'm an astronaut. Laughter bubbled out of me. I'm an astronaut. For a moment, Helen's mouth dropped open, and then she jumped up. Grinning, she ran around the table and swept me into a hug. "I knew it!" She straightened. "Nathaniel! Your wife astronaut!" Across the room, Nathaniel's head jerked up.
"What?"
Carmouche had also stood up at some point.
"Clemens just told her she made the cut. Dr. York is one of the new astronauts."
"Yes!"
Laughing, Nathaniel jumped up and punched the air.
"Yes!"
All around us, engineers and medics and everyone started to cheer. Bubbles and Carmouche and someone else grabbed my chair and lifted me into the air like I was a bride. I laughed and wept and laughed again, clutching the chair as they paraded me around the room. Above us, the skybox flashed with cameras going off. When my chair was back on the ground again, I got swept into a long series of hugs and congratulations. And then Nathaniel had me in his arms. He spun me around, giving me a moment of weightlessness. Kissing him in front of everyone sent me into orbit. When he pulled back, tears brightened his eyes, and a smile threatened to split his face.
"I am so, so proud of you."
This was the way I wanted to learn about becoming an astronaut. Not in a room of random reporters, but here, with my peers, with my husband.
"All right, everyone!"
Clemens bellowed from the doorway.
"We've got a rocket to launch. Back to stations."
I could not stop smiling. Neither Clemens, nor Parker, nor a gaggle of reporters could take this away from me. I was an astronaut. I pulled the numbers for the calculations I'd been doing in front of me and kept losing my place on the page. I was an astronaut. Across the table, Carmouche suddenly threw his hands into the air and shouted,
"La victoire est mienne!"
Helen folded her hands in her lap. "Congratulations, Reynard. You won?"
"Finally!"
He got up and did the most ridiculous victory dance I have ever seen, involving elbows and hips moving in unlikely ways.
"Finally, I have won!"
"Good game." Helen pushed her chair back and stood. She bowed to him.
"Please, excuse me."
My friend, the champion chess player, walked to the ladies' room with her head high and her shoulders back. Do I sound self-important to think that there was a correlation between my news and Helen losing a game? I was an astronaut. Helen wasn't. And that needed to change. 32.
Temperature on upgrade but falls short of 51 high. Chicago, Illinois, June 25th, 1957. At 12:55 p.m. yesterday, the temperature reached 87.7 degrees, and the weatherman, sweltering among his gadgets at Navy Pier, announced that it was heading toward the highest level since the meteor.
I suppose I should report that the Sirius flight went flawlessly. Bubbles was thrilled. Nathaniel was as well, since this would reduce costs for moon runs significantly. Not that we'd landed an astronaut on the moon yet, but it was just a matter of time. And by God, I was going to be one of them. When we left the IAC campus close to dawn, the excitement still had me floating. I looped my arm through Nathaniel's and anticipated another successful rocket launch when we got home. We walked out with the other folks, heading across the parking lot for the gates of the IAC.
There she is!
Flashbulb.
Dr. York!
Flash.
Elma!
Past the gates, a horde of reporters lay in wait.
Over here, ma'am!
My stomach clenched. Nathaniel turned us around, which is a good thing, because I was moving toward them like a moth to the flame, or a lemming to the cliff, more like. He rested his hand on mine and pulled me closer.
We'll have the company send us home in a car.
I didn't think.
Parker should have. Hell. If I'd thought about what happened with him and the rest, I should have.
I don't think that Parker knew about my anxiety. In fact, I'm sure he didn't, or he would have used it to keep me out of the astronauts. But he couldn't have ambushed me better if he'd planned it. One of the UN drivers assigned to the IAC took us home, but when we got to our block, he didn't turn. Nathaniel leaned forward and looked out the window.
Damn it.
Huddled inside my coat, I shivered in the dark of the back seat. He sat back and put his arm around me.
Let's stay at the Aladdin tonight to celebrate.
They have our apartment staked out?
Yeah.
He squeezed me tighter, but my trembling didn't stop. Nathaniel rubbed up and down my arm as if he could chafe the blood back into my veins.
We'll send someone round to get our clothes.
My prescription is in the apartment. It wouldn't make the reporters go away, but it would put a haze between us.
Got it. What do you want to wear tomorrow?
Clothes? I was supposed to think about clothes instead of the wall of reporters waiting to talk to me. On some level, I knew this was coming. I'd seen what had happened when the Artemis 7 were announced. But after months of being the lady astronaut, I thought the level of attention would remain the same. Of course there would be a difference. I'd just gone from being a wannabe astronaut to the real thing. As the first woman that they announced, it made sense that the reporters would all want a piece of me. I tucked my head into Nathaniel's shoulder and let the wool of his coat block out the streetlights.
Sir.
Our driver turned the car down another street.
Is there a different hotel you could choose?
Against my cheek, Nathaniel's chest moved in a sigh.
Let's head to the suburbs. Just pick the first hotel you spot that doesn't have reporters.
After Nathaniel and I spent the night at a Holiday Inn off the interstate, he called Clemens and explained the situation. I was told to avoid the IAC while the reporters were still there and that Mrs. Rogers had accepted my resignation with many congratulations. They hadn't even let me say goodbye to the other computers. I wept, took a Milltown, burrowed under the covers, and when the first Milltown wore off, I took another. Nathaniel stayed in the hotel with me while a UN guard sat outside the door. That was probably a good choice. In the afternoon, our phones started to ring. I don't know how they'd tracked us down, but they had. I was not an astronaut. That was made very, very clear on day one. There were 7 women selected, and our first meeting was not at the IAC. It was not even in Kansas City. They flew us out to the bunker where Nathaniel and I had met the president right after the meteor struck. I guess, after the circus I'd been through, they wanted to keep the rest of us under wraps. When I walked into the conference room, I recognized some of the faces. Betty and Nicole had made the cut and were sitting together at the conference table. Nicole squealed and waved me over.
I wanted to tell you, but they told me I couldn't say anything because of the reporters hanging all over you.
I rolled my eyes. That was a nuisance. Nightmare. Much the same thing. Betty, congratulations. She nodded and bit her lower lip. Swallowing, she looked up.
You too.
That bit of careful social nicety out of the way, I sat down next to Betty and gave the other women my attention. Naturally, Sabia Gochin had made it in. I was glad she'd come back from Turkey for this because flying with her had been a pleasure. Mrs. Le Bourgeois, on the other hand... Last we'd spoken at the launch, Violette had only just begun taking flying lessons. I smiled at her and leaned across the table. Two astronauts in the family? Your husband must be very proud. She blushed and waved.
It is an honor, and so unexpected.
I can imagine. I hadn't even seen her at the testing. Pausing, I looked around the room at the waiting women. No men. Interesting. I knew that they'd added more men to the Corps as well, but they must be training them in a different location. We weren't chattering or doing any of the clucking that you'd expect from the movies. All of us were turned out, though. In pantsuits, yes, but with makeup and our hair done just so. Four of us were American, one French woman, a Brazilian woman, Jacira Paz-Viveros, and Sabia Gochin. Seven, all told, to match the original seven men. If Ida hadn't primed me for it, I don't know if I would have noticed that there wasn't a black candidate in the group. Clemens, Parker, and two other gentlemen that I didn't know walked in together. Clemens clapped his hands together.
There, my beauties. First of all, ladies, congratulations on being chosen as astronauts in training.
One of the men I didn't know. A slender fellow with a shiny white forehead and ears that stuck out past his regulation crew cut started passing out binders.
Now, our first task is to get you ready for the press conference. This is Mr. Pommier.
He beckoned toward the other fellow, who was in his mid-50s and had that steel-gray hair that some men acquire as they age.
He's your stylist and will help you select your wardrobe and hair for the event.
I exchanged glances with Nicole, but neither of us raised our hands to ask why we needed a stylist. They had probably gotten one for the men and kept him on for us. If I were going to rock the boat, which seemed inevitable, then it would be over a bigger question.
Mr. Smith is handing out press kits for each of you. We're going to go through sample interview questions to prepare you for the conference.
Clemens turned to Parker.
Colonel Parker here is in charge of all the astronauts, as well as you lady astronauts in training. He'll be able to help you understand what's expected of you in your new role.
Parker gave one of his trademark earnest smiles.
Good morning. I wish all conference rooms looked this lovely when I walked in.
He caught my eye.
Now, I know some of you are used to being able to say anything you want, but we've got to be careful with the information that goes out of the IAC. Besides our security interests, we also have an exclusive contract with Life. Isn't that right, Miss Rawls?
Betty nodded, her eyes on the table and her cheeks red.
Yes, sir.
Well, bless her journalistic heart. Betty hadn't made the cut. She'd cut a deal.
To control the image of the space program, all communication with the press must go through the front office.
Parker held up a finger.
And just to be clear, the press includes entertainment broadcasts.
This was not the hardship for me that he seemed to think it was.
Wait a minute.
Sabia's voice cut through the room. She had her binder open and was frowning at one of the pages.
This question. What is this answer? No, I am not an astronaut.
I grabbed my binder and flipped it open amid the sound of pages shuffling and covers slapping against the hard wood of the conference table. Sure enough, under the heading, Approved Answers to Common Questions, were a variety of questions about what it was like to be an astronaut.
Thank you, Colonel Parker. I'll take it from here.
Mr. Smith, the fellow with the jug-handled ears, had a voice like a revival preacher. The deep resonance rolled out at complete odds with his slight build.
You've already opened your binders, ladies, so let me explain. We've realized that it would be confusing for the public if we started calling trainees astronauts. It would be like calling someone a pilot when they'd just signed up for flight school.
When exactly are we considered astronauts? My voice left frost on the table.
50 miles.
Parker shrugged.
When you've been 50 miles above the Earth's surface, you're an astronaut. That's in conjunction with the IAC and the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale in Paris.
Until then, you're astronaut candidates, abbreviated as ASCANs.
Of course. All nice and proper and completely legitimate. I couldn't even complain that it was unreasonable, except, of course, that the rule hadn't applied until they'd added women to the Corps. At the press conference, I stood in the shadows backstage with Nathaniel holding both of my hands. A film of sweat separated us. The murmur of the crowd rumbled through the curtains at a constant low